And now, I would like to introduce our main speaker for the evening. Please give a warm welcome to Richard Z from San Diego.
Hi, I'm Richard, and I'm an alcoholic. Thanks, Rebecca, for a nice talk. It's nice to hear you. And I've been where you have. I'll tell you about it a little bit. I'm consider myself one of the luckiest people on the planet to be here tonight and to be sober. I received a gift beyond your wildest dreams by asking God for it, and that's what I'm doing here tonight to talk about that. I'm a Montanan. I grew up on a farm about 11 miles south of the nearest paved road in Golden Valley County. I went to a one-room country school. We had about 960 acres of wheat, barley, and oats, and a bunch of cattle, and no horse. And I was a little bit discontent. I wanted a horse. My dad didn't want to have a horse around because they ate too much hay. And I was pissed at him most of the time because we did not have a horse. A little start out there with self-centeredness. It continued and grew. Unfortunately, it got bigger than the other part of me. I went to a one-room country school with all my cousins. I grew up in a kind of a little German-Russian subculture. And by that I mean my grandfather was a Russian immigrant. They were German descent who had been Russian farmers. And they were run out of Russia by the Bolsheviks. And he was scared every day of his life they were going to come and find him and kill him. And so he drank vodka like it was Kool-Aid. Like you would drink any beverage in your house, like iced tea or something. That's how he drank vodka. And we were little guys. There used to be 8 or 10 of us lined up at the kitchen counter in a big row, and little shot glasses along the top of the counter where he'd pour everybody a shot of vodka, and that's how we started our day at Grandpa's house. You know? And so everybody had a shot of vodka, then he could drink more, and we all enjoyed ourselves and played cards and had a lot of fun. Am I okay? Okay. How's that? Okay, I'll pay attention now. Anyway, so I grew up in this rural background, and I, by the time I was 9 years old, I was pretty messed up kid for some reason. I was starting to sniff gasoline fumes. Accidentally, of course. No peer pressure, nothing like that. And I had my first drink about that same time. I was about 9. I had, at harvest time in rural America, the men drink beer, one beer, after harvest. You know, they were all sweaty. They worked all day in the hot sun. It's about 8:30 at night. Supper's going to be served pretty soon. We call it supper, not dinner. Everybody had a can of Ham's beer. And I found a half can of Ham's beer one time, and I had that half can of Ham's beer. And I'll tell you what, it changed my life. I loved that beer. It made me feel like a man. I thought I was a man. I wasn't. I was a little boy. I was a 9-year-old boy. And from then on, from that second on, all I ever wanted to do was drink. That was my goal in life, is to be a man. I thought men drank. And how I was going to be a man was by drinking. And so every waking hour, I either wanted to drink, I was lying about having drank, or I was contemplating getting beer for some reason from somewhere. And I did. I got very good at it. I was a crafty little bugger. I could steal beer out of your pickup, your car, whatever, and your cigarettes. And I would, you know, by the time I was in the seventh grade, I was smoking Lucky Strikes, chewing tobacco. And didn't do too well in school. Gee, I don't understand why. We drank vodka and orange juice in the boys' room. It said boys on the door, not men. It said boy, B-O-Y-S, right there. We drank in there, a couple of us. Had to have our vodka and orange juice in the morning that we brought to school with us. You know, what the hell, I could have used AA right then, except I just wasn't done drinking. Because it felt really good to me. It felt really good. It made this thing inside of me that was missing. I had a part of me that was just like a vacuum that would suck you in and just use you up, you know. And alcohol made that go away temporarily. And so alcohol was great medicine for what ailed me. Like it says in our literature, I like the effect produced by alcohol. And the effect that I liked was alcohol is an anesthetic, used as an anesthetic, and it just numbed me from all my feelings and pain. It just numbed me. And so I became kind of a numb person, kind of what my dad would call a numbskull. When you're sent to run an errand on the farm, if you came back with the wrong thing, they'd go, what's in there? You know, go get the right tool. And so that's how I grew up. And when I was, sixth, seventh grade, I guess, I think I was about 12 years old when we moved into this little town because we had gone broke farming. I lived in rural poverty. We didn't know it was rural poverty. We had food. We didn't ever have any cash. We always had patched Levi's that were handed down or pants that were handed down from my cousins, older cousins. And I resented the shit out of those guys because they gave us stuff, you know. And we were dependent on them to get our clothes, and I hated that. And so I drank, and I moved into town, and we got in lots of fights because they called us country kids. You know, there was a town of 200 people, and so we learned how to fight. And I fought, and I would slug you at the drop of a hat. It just didn't matter to me what you said. If I didn't like it, I just hit you. That's how we solved problems there, you know. And when I was high school kid, when I was a junior in high school, I was about the same height I am now, and I could jump high enough to put my wrist over the top of the rim at that time. And at that time, that was pretty high for a kid my size in a rural community. And so to tell you what I thought of myself, I remember one Thanksgiving after basketball season started, I was doing really well. The coach came to me, he took me inside, he says, "You got to do really good the next few nights. You know, there are going to be some people here for some colleges you might be interested in." I never even thought about going to college. I was thinking about drinking. And what I did in response to that is I quit playing basketball right then. That's how I treated myself. And I had no idea why I was doing that stuff. I had no idea what was going on with Richard, but that's how I felt inside. I wasn't worthy of that. I didn't have the self-esteem to accept any attention like that at all. However, I craved it. I wanted you to pay attention to me so bad I would act out in school to get attention, but I wouldn't do anything good to get it. So that's how I grew up. So, and the other thing we did as kids is we worked. I was a functioning alcoholic in high school, you know. I worked after school every day hauling drilling mud from this little railroad stop out to the oil fields to drilling rigs. There's a lot of oil there, oil and natural gas, there still is. And we worked in those oil fields, and so I drank like a man. We had hard hats, and you could get served in any bar in the county, no problem. Just sat down there with your hard hat on, and they'd serve you a drink. So I'd get a case of beer, and, you know, I graduated from high school because at that time you just didn't not graduate, you know. My dad had a pretty good job at the Department of Agriculture, and so they just kind of shoved me out the door with a diploma. And I didn't have a plan, because I wanted to drink. I did not have a plan, but we had moved to a new little town, and there was a draft at that time. That was 1968. And my draft number was like number one or three or something like that. Because I was from out of town and I did not know anybody there. There was no way for Richard to get out of that, you know. And so I was a big idea person as a kid too, you know. So I was driving I had this 1950 Ford I had bought with my own money. It cost $125. And that was my car. And a case of beer would slide right underneath the front seat. It was a great car, you know. And I was driving. I was kind of concerned about what to do about this draft thing. You know, I didn't like the idea of getting. My dad was a World War II veteran. My uncle was a World War II veteran. We were had a very patriotic family. I'm still very patriotic. And what happened though is I thought, God, why don't you know? I was driving by the post office and I see the Navy recruiter's car parked there. And this little light just went on in my head. There was an idea, you know. A big ideas. And so I just parked my car and went right in there. I talked to the Navy recruiter. And in 14 days, I was gone. And I had never been back to that town. And I consider that today God's will. That was God's will for me. And I wound up in the Navy, and I thought about the service at the time, especially the Navy, is my picture of a sailor was a drunken sailor. I didn't think of a sailor that had a job who did something for his country. I thought of a guy who got to drink in lots of cool places with chicks, you know. And I was a drunken sailor right away. You know, I mean, I didn't have to practice at becoming a drunken sailor. I just was. As soon as they put the suit on me, I was a drunken sailor. And that didn't matter much in the Navy at that time. Everybody was a drunken sailor, you know. If you weren't a drunken sailor, you weren't part of the group there, you know. And so in boot camp, they kind of run you through this series of tests and stuff, and I was not a dumb kid. I was not, I would always take these tests, and I would always be just stunned by the results. They would come to me and go, what is wrong with you? And I go, oh, God, I'd start my excuses. No, I don't know. I was my mother, whatever, you know. And they'd say, God, you scored the highest score on this test. Why are you doing? Why are you acting like this? And I didn't get it. I couldn't put the part together where I actually had a brain. God had given me a brain. And I just couldn't have the self-esteem to use it. I just didn't have what it took to make that thing work for me, you know. I used it to destroy my life, basically. Because I was smarter than you. And if you didn't know it, I would soon point it out, you know. And if I thought you were smarter than me, secretly I would still think you were smarter. I was smarter than you. Secretly, I would never try to tell you that, though. But so they decided that I was going to become a Navy hospital corpsman. And my dad was a medic in the Army in World War II, and I thought, that's not a bad job. I'll give that a try. And little did I know that that wasn't a Navy job. That was a Marine Corps job. I was rudely awakened when I graduated from hospital corps school at Great Lakes, Illinois. I got orders to Camp Lejeune, North Carolina. I was stunned. And I go to the chief and I go, Chief, what the hell is this? Aren't I in the Navy? And he goes, not anymore. he goes, you're going to Camp Lejeune to get your Marine Corps uniform and you're going to spend the rest of your time with those Marines. So I go down to Camp Lejeune. I kind of liked it there because we drank and fought. You know, it was a wonderful place for me. And drank a lot of 3-2 beer. You could just drink that stuff till you just puke it out your nose, you know, at night, and then drink some more. And then get in a big fight with 10 over Marines over some girl in go-go boots and a miniskirt, you know, dancing at some sleazy bar in Jacksonville, North Carolina. That's how the military worked for me. And then I got sent to the National Naval Medical Center at Bethesda, Maryland, and it was the first time I'd ever seen anybody wounded from war. And I worked in plastic and thoracic surgery and went to operating room tech school, and things got real serious for Richard because there are people that are really, really ripped up. Casualties. And when I graduated from OR Tech School, I was walking down the hallway the very next day, and some guy caught up with me and he said, here's your orders. And those orders were to NSA Da Nang. And I was gone in 48 hours. I didn't get the promised 30 days leave. And they had offended me then. You know, I was pissed, and my solution to that was to drink more, you know. And I found some other substances because you couldn't always drink on the job there, you know. And because I was an OR tech, and I worked at NSA Da Nang, which was the Navy hospital there, kind of a station hospital place, and I got to ride around in the back of the helicopter in the field to pick up people and bring them back to the hospital or to the reposer sanctuary, and did that for about 18 months because my tour of duty was a year, and there was no replacements. So we just stayed there. And I had kind of given up hope on myself at about 11 months. I knew I wasn't going to rotate at 12 months. So I just kind of quit mentally on everything. I gave up and I started just to be pissed all the time. And I drank a lot of whiskey. We also had this little deal where we had to stay awake a lot. A lot of hours sometimes. You'd have to stay awake 72 hours, longer than that sometimes in a row because there were operations and you just can't go to sleep. You just can't quit and walk away, you know. It's like one of those deals where, oh, shit, I'm going to take a break. No, you don't get a break today. And so we have these things called Dexamil spanchols, and they're time-release speed, real good pharmaceutical-grade speed. So we used those and drank. And that's how I ran my life, basically. That's how I managed Richard's life. And so then one day, this big order came out to release everybody that was on extended duty. I was one of those guys, and I went down and sat by the runway and for 2 days and waited for the transport plane. I wouldn't do anything else. I quit. And they got us home. We landed at March Air Force Base, and then I found out what the deal really was. It was that when our bus left March Air Force Base, there were people throwing rotten eggs at us, calling us baby killers, and spitting on us. It was a horrible thing. The bus driver would not stop. We demanded he stop. They would not stop for us. And to this day, I wish they would have stopped because we'd all be in jail for murder. But so that was God's will, too. And they sent us to 29 Palms, of all places, you know. And it was way in the hell out in the desert at that time. There was nothing out there except for a couple bars right off the base. And that's where we lived, pretty much, at the sand trap, right off the bar, the first bar on the right hand side off the base. And we drank and raised hell. That's what we did because we didn't think we owed the government anything else, you know. And so the group of us that came back together got split up. I got sent to Camp Pendleton, and that's where I got discharged from in 1972. Honorably, believe it or not. With a nice clean record. And that was primarily because we took care of our own records. We were stationed in the Marine Corps, so we had a corpsman take care of our records because they didn't want to take care of our stuff. They just took care of their stuff, and we always had this conflict. And so my discharge papers were signed by some chief, you know. That's, you know, pretty much just, here you go, get out of here. Here's your wad of cash, see you later, you know. And God, I swear to God, I'd rather haul garbage than stay in the Navy, you know. And I got out of the Navy, and I had picked up a little Navy bride along the way. Cute little thing, innocent, you know. We lived over here in East San Diego when those apartments were brand new. Those Huffman apartments were all brand new then before they became slums. You know, we lived in one of those brand new apartments. God, life was good. I had a brand new car. We drove up and down I-5 as fast as we could go because there was no traffic. Four lanes, no traffic. It was just amazing. I wonder what the hell they built this freeway for. You know? Well, today we know why they built it. No, they knew why they were going to build it too. And anyway, so I moved back to Billings, Montana to go to attend college. And, you know, my Navy bride came with me. She'd never seen a guy at breakfast in a cowboy hat. Kind of amazing, isn't it? You know, never seen a guy eating breakfast with his cowboy hat on. It kind of offended her, you know. But what really offended her was that I had very rare times when I was sober at all. You know, I mean, I was writing checks for 89 cents in the grocery store because that's all she'd give me in the checkbook. So that I could get a quart of beer. You know, that's who I was. And I was calling her names and kicking her out of the car while we were driving down the street. We had a great relationship. You know? And you know, she had the gall to leave. Isn't that amazing? She packed her stuff and left one night without my consent. You know. And so I drank over that for 2 or 3 years. And then I had, you know, I had another big brainstorm. I should get back to San Diego. It was nice there. You know, it was in the wintertime. It's colder than hell, 20 below zero, something like that. And I hopped in my Ford Bronco. It took me 20 minutes to pack all my crap. That's what I owned at that time. And I was back in San Diego living with a former Navy buddy, you know. And things got worse for me. I got kicked out of place after place after place because I just couldn't work. I couldn't keep a job. I couldn't stay sober one day. I didn't want to. If you asked me, why don't you stop drinking? I'd go, well, I could if I wanted to, but I don't want to, you know. And it was a lie. It was a lie because I could not stop. There was just no possibility of me stopping drinking, you know. And I hung out at the bars on University Avenue, like the Tower was my main hangout. No? The cool places, yeah. The Rack 'em Up. That was kind of a high-end, the Tower, for that neighborhood. The Rack 'em Up and some other poorhouse, some places like that. Down the Cuckoo Club, you know, really, really exciting nightlife there, you know. A lot of Hell's Angels and stuff. We had a great time over there fighting, beating each other up. And one night, what happened to me was I received a gift, the gift of desperation one night. And how it worked for me is I drank all day. I used to put in a lot of long days at those bars, like 6 in the morning till whenever they kicked you out, you know. And if you could stay, hang around outside all night and go back in the next day, if you could write a bad check, whatever it took, you know, to drink, that was it. And that was my whole life. I couldn't keep a job. I had a piece work job, making golf clubs in El Cajon, and I'd drive out there and drive back to my place in the alley. I had a garage in the alley that I rented, and I just lived in there, you know. And my neighbor was this guy who lived in his Cadillac, and he always pissed me off because he kept the motor running to stay warm, of all things, you know. How could he, you know, and on my turf. And one night, I just kind of woke up one night instead of being passed out. I came back to that little place, and I was kind of alert for some reason. And I could see how screwed up my life was. I could see every little teeny bit of it. And it was pathetic. And I felt so bad about myself inside. I had no... And see, for a big thinker, a big planner like me, I had no plan. I didn't have a plan left. I couldn't think of anything to do, who to con, who to bullshit, you know, who to get $50 from. I just couldn't come up with it. You know, I couldn't come up with another idea. And I did what a Catholic nun taught me how to do when I was a little boy. And when I was a little boy, we went to catechism for a couple weeks because we were country kids. We'd come to town and they'd have a nun or two come and teach us catechism. And she caught me smoking a cigar with a Protestant kid. You know, the cigar wasn't the problem. It was with the Protestant kid was the problem. And she told me, she says, Richard, I'm going to teach you how to pray because you're going to need to learn this. And she says, I want, because of who you are, I want to teach you a really simple prayer. And she said, the prayer is, God help me. She said, that's it. She said, if you're honest, he'll help you. And that night I said, God help me. And the next day I wound up in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I haven't had a drink or a drug since that second. And that was October 1st, 1978, or sometime about the last week of September of 1978. And the next, you know, my first sponsor told me that it was October 1st because I had lied to him about the real date. He said, you don't really know. And I didn't really know. It was sometime the last week of September. I attended my first meeting, which was the 1 o'clock meeting at Pathfinders. And there's somebody here who might have been in that room that day. And boy, I was a mess. I was full of fear. I had a beard down to about here. I was dirty. I hated everybody. I would just stare at you. If you came close to me, I would just glare at you from across the room. And I sat next to the wall. And I'll tell you, somebody paid a 12-step call on me at that meeting that probably didn't know he did it, but was the best thing anybody could have ever done for a guy like me. And I, right when the meeting, I don't have any idea what was said in the meeting. I don't remember one word that happened in there. I know I was scared and I wanted to get the hell out of there. And I was headed out that door and down the steps, and there was a guy, there was a chubby guy in a white T-shirt standing at the bottom of the steps. And he looked at me like he could see what was I was thinking way back in here, you know. And I was thinking, I'm screw these people, I'm out of here, you know. And he said to me, he just looked at me and kind of grinned, and he said, I'll see you tomorrow. God, I couldn't believe it. Somebody asked me to come back. I mean, it was amazing, you know. And he said, I'll see you tomorrow. It was like a command, you know. And I was there the next day, and the next day, and the next day, and the next day. And finally, these little miracles started to happen to me. The obsession, I didn't have the obsession to drink. That was gone from my God help me prayer. That took care of that problem. But I had Richard. All the crap and resentment and hate and discontent, malcontent, all that stuff. I came to AA with all that stuff. Right with me, you know. And the first thing that happened that I consider miraculous was that I didn't know that God had removed the obsession for me to drink until I was standing out on the porch after that meeting one day talking to this cowboy guy, kind of guy who tried to be a cowboy. And I asked him, I said, when do you think the obsession's going to be removed? And he goes, looked at me like I was just nuts. And he goes, if you had the obsession to drink, wouldn't you be drinking right now? And I went, whoa, it's gone. I had no desire to drink from the first day. I mean, I was shaky, my head hurt. And then God started to put people in my life that I could deal with. See, I was afraid of everybody. I was abused as a kid by my mother and an uncle. And so I was afraid of men and women kind of equally. I had no use for almost anybody on the planet. And for you, I thought that, first off, how I detoxed was like this. I would get about this much sugar in the bottom of one of those styrofoam cups. And then that much cream and that much coffee. And that was my 4 or 5 drinks a meeting. And then I'd feel better. You know, that was a meeting for me. Then I'd feel better. And I always try to get to that meeting early because they put out sugar cookies. And I'd always try to get 3 sugar cookies, not my regular 2. So I'd have something to eat that day. And then I'd get my coffee with the stuff in it. And then my head wouldn't hurt as bad. And I was at the coffee pot one day doing my concoction, and this guy offered to give me his phone number. I said, you know, okay, I don't have a phone. What? It's not going to work very well, but I'll keep you in mind, you know. And he says, he opened his wallet, and he had a Montana driver's license. And, you know, I trusted him because he was from my home state, and he was from Great Falls, Montana. He was working on a drilling rig up at Long Beach and had some relatives down here or something he was visiting. And he used to take me to a little Mexican place over there in Golden Hill and get a taco or something before the meeting. And he always looked at me like he was watching some kind of experiment. He'd look at me like, God, I wonder what's going to happen. You know, any second his top of his head's going to blow off. Because I was always just expletive about these people in the meetings. It pissed me off. Because they laughed a lot, you know. They were having fun. They looked like they knew each other. It just irritated the crap out of me that they could have that much fun right in front of me, you know. And not apologize for it, you know. They didn't even know who they were or who I was. The problem was they did know who I was. Anyway, the next thing that happened, and I think this is equally as important, is I got to trust one person. And the next thing that happened was that Somebody asked me to read How It Works. And I didn't have any idea what was going on in that meeting. No, I didn't know there was some way to stay sober that you could actually do a process and keep yourself sober long term. I didn't know that could happen. I thought I'd be there a few months and just blow everybody off and go get drunk again. I didn't have any idea what was going to happen. And I looked down, there was an old rickety podium there, and they had taped to it this thing that said How It Works. It said it right there in front of me. They didn't hide it. It said How It Works. I couldn't believe it. They had written it down. I thought I was going to have to learn the AA handshake, you know, the thing, like whatever, or get the right wink, or, you know, do something untoward to somebody after the meeting, or rake somebody's lawn, or be in the hierarchy like Amway, or something like that. I had to pay somebody, they'd pay, and then people would start paying me, and that's what I thought the basket was about. You know? I had no idea that there was a thing called How It Works. You could actually follow somebody else's directions and get this thing. It's amazing. It's written down. Anybody can have it. It's incredible. You know, and I figured out, after I talked to the cowboy guy a few times, I figured out that I had taken the first couple steps in that alley all by myself. I had become powerless over alcohol. I sure as hell wouldn't ask for help if I wouldn't have. And I had became willing to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. That's the first two couple steps. And I started on the third step. And I formalized that third step when I got a sponsor, but that's where I was that day. And he pointed that out to me. He says, you've already taken these steps. Well, you wouldn't be here if you hadn't. He says, you need to get somebody and get on your knees quick. This isn't going to last long. You know, you've been granted some grace. You need to get on your knees quick here and get this over with. And get on with the fourth step. Get this stuff off your back and get moving, you know. That's how I was treated. We didn't talk about the baseball scores, stuff like that. That was like stuff for the guys who had 8 or 10 years to sit around and shoot the shit about. Between the people who talked to me, we talked about the steps. That was pretty much it. That's all I really remember, you know. And so I fell into this group of kind of step Nazis, you know, who we took the steps, we talked about the steps, and everybody laughed about their problems, you know. It was incredible for me. It was an incredible place. And they said really profane things in God in the same sentence. And it just made me giggle inside when that happened. You know, I thought, God, this is so irreverent, I've got to stay. You know, this is perfect for me. It's a perfect place for a guy like me, a little Catholic boy who thinks he's bigger than God. You know, and I'm not. I'll guarantee that. And I'll tell you something else. It just tickles me inside when I tell people how I got sober, because God helped me when I said, God help me. That was it for me. That's it. You know, I didn't do anything else. That's it. It's hilarious because I came there without the obsession to drink, with no sponsor. I'd never seen a big book. I'd never seen How It Works. I had no idea what was going on in AA, and I had the obsession to drink had been removed. God was doing for me what I could not do for myself right away. And to follow through with that, I was told that I needed to take the rest of those steps to clear away the wreckage in my past so that I could go out and be useful to other people in the name of AA. That I was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous now, and that I had something to contribute because of that. And I needed to clean my act up to do that. Unfortunately, that took me years. You know, I'm not a quick study. I'm a very, very slow learner. And I had a pretty severe post-traumatic stress disorder and a couple other little problems that some of you might be familiar with. I have a really small ear holes, and I can only hear a little bit at a time. And my skull is really thick. So, you know, most of these new ideas bounce off my head before I get them a few times. I have to sit in meetings for days over and over and over until I hear what I need to hear. You know, it takes a long time. And then I had this other problem when I came, which is really a medical problem. I shouldn't probably talk about it here, but it's called optic rectitis. And I had this deal where the nerve endings from your retina and your anus get mixed up, and you have a crappy outlook on life. So that's how hard it was for me. You think you had it tough with your drug addiction and all that crap? I had optic rectitis. So take that. And, I really didn't want a sponsor. I didn't want anybody to tell me what to do. You know, I had my pride. You know, I came there with some pride, damn it. You just didn't get to boss me around. I didn't want to mow your lawn or anything. And I heard all this crap, and I thought, that's not for me. And So I fell into this group of step Nazis who got me going to this Friday night meeting, and I went there religiously for about 5 years. And I learned some things about myself there. I remember the first time I ever laughed was after that meeting one night. It was about an hour and a half meeting, and I caught myself in the parking lot with these guys just laughing my butt off. And my face felt weird. I hadn't laughed for years and years. I'm not a big smiler. And my face felt funny. I was laughing so hard. And I don't even know what the hell I was laughing about. And this old timer walked up to me and he says, "What are you laughing about?" And I said, "You know, I don't know." And he says, "You found a way out, didn't you, you little asshole?" that was one of the guys who was became a spiritual mentor to me. You know, not my sponsor, but my sponsor's sponsor. That's what he said to me. And then the other thing that happened is the first time I shared from this little rickety podium at that 1 o'clock meeting, this guy came up to me right afterwards. It was like he was just rushing up there to talk to me. And I thought, oh, wow, here's a guy to talk to, you know. And I had this kind of shield around me. It was about this thick of just crap, you know. And if you kind of touched it, it'd hurt, you know. I bit, you know. And he kind of poked his card. He had this card printed up, and he kind of poked it like he was poking it through a slot in my crap. You know, and he kind of poked it in there. And he handed it to me and he says, "Here, take my number. I think I can help you." He says, "When you get done beating your spoon on your high chair." Boy, I was pissed. I was pissed for about a month at him. I wouldn't come near him. You know, he'd be sitting at the meeting looking at me, just grinning, and I'd walk all the way around him. Get to that coffee pot. I hated that son of a gun to talk to me like that. You know, after I had poured my heart out at that podium, he said something like that. What kind of deal is this? You know, and I thought, I'm not going to ever talk to him. And of course, a month later, I was talking to him, and that guy helped me a lot. And it turns out he was one of those guys who had, been in New York and around the beginnings of Alcoholics Anonymous. He was a real old timer, you know, and that's how they treated newcomers. And I asked him right away. I said, I asked him to be my sponsor, you know, and I said, "Could you be my sponsor?" And he goes, "I was over at his house." And he had this drawer full of old big books and markers and shit, you know, and he opens this drawer with both hands and kind of stuck, and he pulls it open, he rummages around in there, and he comes up with this great big red marker and a big book, and he hands it to me, and he says, "Here, you take this home, and you underline everything it says about sponsorship in there, and then you call me." Of course, there's not a word about it. But he got me to read the big book again. Not one word, you know. It doesn't say the word sponsor in there anywhere, you know. And man, I lucked too, because I'm a reader. I was a reader. That was one of my escapes when I was a kid. I can read, man. When I was in junior high school, they gave us this reading intelligence test, and they couldn't test it. You know, it was off the charts. I would ace. They'd make me take the test 3 times because they thought I was cheating, you know. And that's how my reading comprehension is. And an eighth grade girl taught me how to read in that one-room country school. So I received some gifts along the way, and I didn't even know I had received them. That's how selfish I was. I had no idea I could read like that. And when I got sober, I couldn't read like that. All I could read was about a half a paragraph before my mind would just race off into something else, you know. And then I'd start reading that paragraph again, and I'd fall asleep. So that was my sleeping medication for a long time. That's what I took. That was my sleeping pill, the big book. And then finally I got to where I could start to read it. And I read along in there, and I had become willing to go to any length, you know, because of my own experience, not your experience or anybody else's, because of my own crap, I had become willing to go to any length. And so I was determined to do whatever they said in there. And I figured out all on my own that these people had written their experience down. And so I went through there and I looked for the verbs, action words, and I tried to do them as good as I could. Most of the time, my actions didn't measure up to what they said they had done in there in any way. But I tried. I was willing and I tried. And I reached out to people to talk to them about it. I would find old-timers in meetings and ask them, "Hey, how did you do this, blah, blah, blah." And so when I got to the third step, I realized I was going to need somebody else, and I wasn't going to go talk to a priest. You know, I was done with those people. That's how arrogant I am, you know. Like, I'll show you bastards. I'll never show up again, you know. You'll be screwed without me. They were just fine. You know? So, the sponsor guy I got, we took the third step together by holding hands, which was just offensive to me beyond belief. In the front seat of his Volkswagen at some meeting out in La Mesa one night, because that's the meeting he went to. By the way, how he sponsored me was like this. He would tell me what meetings he attended, and I could meet him there before the meeting to set up the chairs. That's when I got to talk to him. Or after his golf game on Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock, I could call him before 4. Because he had a family and a job, and I wasn't going to screw it up for him. That's how I was sponsored. And so when I had questions, which I did every Sunday, I called him with questions. And then when we took the third step, he says, "Here, I have a suggestion for you." And I said, "What's that?" And he was into doing things for 90 days. He was on this 90-day thing, you know. And he says, "Why don't you get on your knees in the morning and at night and say the third step prayer and see what happens?" I go, "Okay, I'll show him. I'll try it. And I know it can't change me. I mean, I'm so unique and screwed up, he can't help me, you know." And so after about 15 days of doing that, I got interested in the fourth step. You know, I started reading about the fourth step in the big book, and I just didn't. I didn't think I quite got it. But I also had this need that I had brought with me to AA for attention, you know. And I like to get attention from people by asking questions. I learned that they'll give you attention if you ask questions, you know. And what I didn't know is that most of the old-timers were way more cunning than I was. And so this first guy I went to with the big, I didn't have the big book, but I asked him some question about the fourth step. And he says, let's talk about it. Now, I thought he meant tomorrow, you know, because I never did anything that day, you know. Tomorrow was my day, you know. And it's the day for an alcoholic. Tomorrow is. Now you can go in any bar in town, and they'll all tell you this is going to happen tomorrow. Or next week is a really better day because you need to drink through the holidays here, you know, or whatever. You know? But tomorrow's really was my day, and I thought for sure we were going to talk tomorrow. I'll meet you at some meeting. Maybe he'd buy me lunch, you know. That didn't happen. So what he did say though is he says, "Go get the big book. Let's talk about it." I thought, "Ooh, something's different about this guy." And there was a big couch there, and he says, all the people from the meeting were outside. He says, "Sit down here, let's talk about this." And he opens the big book up to this diagram of the fourth step there, and he says, "Do you know what this word means?" And I looked at the word, and the word is self, S-E-L-F. And I go, I started to say no, and he goes, he tapped me right here as hard as he could with his finger. He goes, "I think you do," like that. God, he caught me lying to him. You know, and for a second I knew I was just bullshitting this guy, and he pulled my little emotional trousers right down right there, and we took the third step together that day, and we started talking about selfishness and self-centeredness and how it had ruined my life, and I was able to point out to him about 10 ways that selfishness had screwed my life up right that second. It just became obvious to me. And then he says, "All you have to do is go home and write an inventory of self-centeredness. That's what we're writing this inventory about." I went home and wrote it in about 2 hours. I called my sponsor, and he said, "Sit on it for a week." You know, Jesus, what a loser that guy was. You know, sit on it for a week. And I did. I sat on it for a week, and a bunch more stuff came up. The other thing that my sponsor is, I did not know what a lot of words meant. I thought I did, but I just couldn't quite get a handle on them. And I don't know if I was detoxing or my brain was screwed up or whatever. He says, "Do you know what the word resentment means?" And then he would always catch me before the lie came out. He would say, "Don't lie to me," you know, like that. And I'd go, "Okay, I don't know." And I'd kind of be, I was kind of a smartass, "I don't know," you know, like that. Because I really thought I did, but I didn't want to let him know that I knew he knew, you know. I was way smarter than him, but I didn't want him to figure that out. And because I was really tricking him, you know. He goes, "Do you have a grudge?" And I went, "Whew, grudge. Doesn't everybody have a grudge?" "Of course I've got a grudge. I've got a grudge. I could name 50 of them right now, you know, that I'm going to show these people too." And he goes, "That's what you want to write down here, those grudges." So I made a grudge list. And I took it and read it to him, and it was easy. After I knew what selfishness was, this whole thing unfolded for me really, really, really pretty simply. It wasn't a big complicated psychological deal. That all came later, you know. When the real work started. But I got this stuff off my back. I got the heat off my back. I got all my grudges off my back. I got to practice being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous by making coffee. I made coffee at that Friday night meeting, it seemed like for years. Because I'd be making coffee when they elected the new coffee maker. And it was always me, because I was too stupid to go in there and go, no, I don't want to do this anymore. So I'd be the coffee maker again for another month, you know. And then the coffee maker was supposed to be the leader the next month, and I missed that a couple times too, because they'd go, oh, no, we'll just let him make coffee again, you know. So I was the dummy in there making these three giant pots of coffee, and I had that resentment to write about. So I learned how to write about all my little chicken shit resentments, you know. And the little miracles just kept happening for me, those little miracles like that, like people telling me things that I just did not understand in really rude ways. I consider miraculous, because that's what it took for me to hear what I needed to hear, you know. That's what it took for me to, you know, I was used to being with some Marine Corps lieutenant telling you to run your ass off, and you ran, you know. So I understood the ordering around, thank you, thing. And I got myself through the rest of the steps, and I got into the 12 step, and I got to where I could go on 12 step calls. That was back when there weren't a lot of institutions in San Diego County, and we really went on 12 step calls. And we really took people home with us. I took people back to my apartment. I didn't live in the alley anymore. And then I got a job. I got a job without my own consent. I got sober without my own consent. I got a job I didn't even want. And I worked at this company for 10 years, and it grew from 23 people. I was the 23rd person they hired to about 260 people and $30 million a year in sales. And I was there for that whole time. And I got rewarded for being there for that. And I got to be really well off, way better than my wildest dreams, way, way more than my wildest dreams. And how I did it was this. I always had resentments. I'm very sensitive. People hurt my feelings at work. They don't pay attention to me. I don't like that. So what I do about it is I write inventories. And I would write my inventory down, and I'd go visit this guy at the six-step house in Leucadia in his milk truck. And I'd knock on the door in my little suit and tie, and this guy in his milk truck would go, come in. You know, he lived in a milk truck, and I'm going to him for help, you know. I thought about that a few times. I thought, this is really something's wrong with this. You know? And I'd go in there, and I'd read him my resentment, and he'd say to me something like this. I'm not quite sure how he worded it, but it always got through my problem with my ears, you know. He'd say, could you go back there and figure out a way to be of service to those people? You're kidding. I'd say, you're kidding. He goes, isn't that what they're paying you for? No. I go, yeah. And every time, this is like magic, every time I went there with this attitude to give something rather than get something, I got something. It's just screwed up. How could that be? So today, my whole goal in life is to be a giver, not a taker. You know, that's my goal. I'm not very good at it all the time. But my goal is to be a giver, not a taker. And my goal is to, my primary purpose is to stay sober and help another alcoholic to achieve sobriety. I've had all kinds of corporate goals. I was involved after that startup was sold off to a company from Georgia. I was involved in three more startups that were successful, one that was a failure. I've been really, really lucky in business and really, really gifted at it. It just came to me. It's just easy for me. And I was always ashamed to admit that because I had this sense of self that blocked me from God. I always had this self-centeredness, this whole thing I created, this false image of myself that didn't mean anything to anybody. It just scared people away. That blocked the real Richard from God, this inner man that they used to talk about. The inner man was blocked off by resentment, fear, and hatred. Literally hatred. And I'll tell you, I am so grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. This is my life. And people say, well, you have AA and then your life. No. I have AA. That's it. AA is my life. These principles go with me wherever I go. I don't always practice them perfectly. I still sulk and pout when I don't get what I want. You know, God, I'm so ashamed of myself sometimes I can't believe it. I'll catch myself pouting. I'll go, Richard, you're pouting. What the hell is this? I'm still this little boy inside sometimes, you know. And I have to live with that. And I have received the gift of sobriety beyond my wildest dreams. Now, this is like, for a guy like me to be sober this long is not possible. And if you knew me when I came, you would know it's not possible for me. It's not possible for me to be here tonight. And I thank you very much for your attention and let me share with your group. Thanks.